It's my favorite time of every 2 weeks. Welcome back to the Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. I'm Jacob Rudner, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. And Peter, we have reached the episode. This is the last time in the year 2025 that you and I will convene to talk college ball. Next time you and I get together will be after the new year. We're going to take a little bit of a break after this podcast, but we are so looking forward to 2026, because once we get to that point and we release our first episode, you will be hearing from us once again once a week. That has not happened now in some time. Our off-season schedule had us every other week. Now we will go back to our normal in-season format, which is a weekly podcast. We're going to go on Mondays. Publish has been Tuesdays in the off-season, so we're going to get back to our normal day and our normal schedule. And before we get into the final college podcast of the 2025 calendar year, I must ask you as always, Peter, how are you? What's the latest? What are some of the things that we're looking forward to during this holiday break? And then subsequently, how excited to get back in 2026 and get rocking on college ball here?
I'm doing great. I think that I'm going to echo your sentiments because I'm one, very excited to get back into our groove of getting together once a week and chopping it up on a weekly basis as opposed to every other week. And also, as I noted on our last episode, the college season is, you know, a month and a half plus away right now, but it sort of feels like once the new year hits and we get back from this holiday break, it's kind of go, go, go mode until the last pitch of the College World Series, even beyond that with the transfer portal. So it's an exciting time of year for a number of reasons, but I also think that, you know, the relief that you and I feel and everyone on staff feels that like the prospect handbook rush is in the rearview mirror and the book is all done and we can kind of go back to our respective lanes, so to speak. It's a great feeling heading into the holidays, and I think it's going to make these next like handful of days all the more rewarding, though I know like we say that, but you and I will be texting as we do basically a daily basis, nightly basis, and Carlos and Jeff and Jesus, and really I could have named everyone on the staff, but we'll be texting about guys that we like or guys that we're seeing or like sitting down and grinding synergies. But that's a long-winded way of saying that this will be a good chapter to close, and I'm very, very excited for the season because it is just now appearing on the horizon and it's going to be here like that.
You know, you mentioned something that it's important before we actually get into today's show, which is that if you want to see the tremendous amount of work that Peter just referenced, that our entire staff puts in at the end of the year towards the prospect handbook, I would encourage you to do so. And you can by going over to baseballamerica.com, then you can look at the top toolbar that exists on the site and you'll see a little tab called store. And there you can do two things that I think are important. One is subscribe to the magazine because we have our first magazine of the calendar year coming out in 2026. That'll be the college preview. We'll also have some fantasy baseball content in there from our colleague Jeff Ponce, who does an outstanding job. So if you're interested in college baseball and in fantasy baseball, that one makes a lot of sense for you. And then the prospect handbook, you can bundle the books together and get all three of our books, the directory and the 2026 almanac that come out along with the handbook. And I believe as well, if you order that bundle, you can get a digital version of all three of those books when they become available. So a great deal. Again, that's baseballamerica.com. Go to the store tab, and then you can pick the things that you want to order for the holiday season. They make great gifts as well. So if you're still looking to do some holiday shopping, do that. Now let's talk about the fact, Peter, that there is still a tremendous amount of news that's been happening in college baseball. This is probably the busiest news cycle in college baseball that I've seen for this late in the calendar. We're talking like October, November, December things happening, including head coaches who are taking professional jobs. You and I have talked about that. We've written about it over at baseballamerica.com. That was a big deal. And then this week, probably my favorite story of the offseason unfolds, and that is Japanese right-hander Genai Sato. And I want to make clear, if I'm butchering his first name pronunciation, that's entirely possible. Let me know in the comments if that's what's happening. But he's making the move over from Japan. He's headed to Penn State. He's officially signed. And I think that the reaction across the college baseball landscape when all of that unfolded and it became clear that he was going to be a Nittany Lion was basically quickly summarized as how? How is this guy going to be a Penn State Nittany Lion? And the story is fascinating. He was going to be eligible for the 2027 draft. He will play for Penn State in the 2027 season. And I think that it is easy to assume that this came down to NIL and Penn State putting together some sort of lucrative package to get the most enticing international college baseball prospect onto their roster. But I can tell you confidently that that is not really the case. This came down to two main factors. One, Mike Gambino and staff did a great job of getting into this recruitment, aligning with the right people, having the right kinds of very quiet, behind closed doors conversations that allowed them to start and finish as the front runner in this recruitment. And then the other important piece of this is an athlete by the name of Masanosuke Ono, who is a wrestler, a world championship caliber wrestler at Penn State right now. And his presence on campus allowed the agents, the handlers for Genai Sato to basically say, this is a school with the infrastructure to take in an elite Japanese talent to help with the transition to the United States and to put this guy in a position to be successful. My question to you is this: what was the level of shock, the shock factor, when you found out that Genai Sato was heading to Penn State? And just how big of a win is this for that program?
This all happened really, really fast because you wrote a story last week, I think around the 15th or the 16th, and it was just making note that he would be foregoing this year's NPB draft in Japan and instead coming over to the United States and pursuing a career at a four-year school prior to being eligible for the Major League Baseball draft. And that was last week. And then over the weekend, you know, as we were talking, and this was just, you know, behind closed doors, you know, you were saying, you know, there was steam and momentum that he might end up at Penn State. And I think the reaction was sort of like, whoa, you know, because I mean, when looking at the caliber of a prospect he is, and this isn't any disrespect or slight to Penn State, you know, you kind of envisioned him ending up at, you know, one of the, you know, big time SEC school or an ACC school. But this was it kind of came to fruition over the weekend that he would be going to Penn State and officially announced yesterday. But in terms of a recruiting win for Penn State, I don't want to be hyperbolic and rash and reactionary and looking at it through like rose-colored glasses and being a prisoner of the moment. But in recent memory, and you can stretch recent memory to however far back you want to go, it feels like the biggest recruiting win in program history. And people who are listening can hear the hesitancy in my voice because that's a huge statement to make. But at least in recent memory, it's the biggest recruiting win. Because again, we'll get into the caliber of a pitcher he is, but you know, he has a chance to be a real, real difference maker in what will presumably be his lone season in College Station next year in 2027. But it's hard to immediately put my finger on a recruiting win that exceeds this, at least in terms of the caliber of prospect that player is when arriving on campus. So I hope that better articulates how I feel about it. But I can't say enough about what a great job Coach Gambino and his staff did in getting this done, and also what a great job they've done since taking the reins of the program. It sort of feels like they're on a steady trajectory up, and I think that's going to be key for competing at a high level in the new look Big Ten.
No, I think that you bring up two really important things there. One of them is that the history of this, when we say like this is the best signing potentially in the history of Penn State, it's certainly no slight at all to this coaching staff, which only got there a couple seasons ago. This is their third year at Penn State. They've actually shown a lot of improvement, especially relative to the school's history. Those have been some pretty good Penn State teams, I think, you know, compared to what expectations are like in State College, Pennsylvania. But There is a lot of context that points to you being correct. And I know that you were hesitant to label this as the best signing in school history. And that's fair because, you know, there's a lot of history, you know, even if it's not necessarily glowingly successful, there's a lot of history in baseball at Penn State. But I would argue that this is probably the top recruitment that the school has ever seen. They have had 14 top 10 round draft picks ever. They have not had a top three rounds draft pick or a first rounder since 1998. This is Nate Bump was the righty was the pick at that time that set that last piece of history. But the bottom line is it has been a quarter century plus since Penn State has had a prospect with true first round upside. And it's not like sneak into the back of the first round upside. We're talking like prominent first round pick type caliber pitcher here, if everything goes right. That kind of player has not existed really in the history of Penn State. So, providing he comes over to the United States and is as successful as a lot of people believe he can be, and that's speaking for myself. I believe that's speaking for you. I know that that's reflective over some of the conversations who I've had that I've had with college coaches and scouts and scouting directors. There is a pretty widespread expectation that the upside is huge. One thing I want to touch on before we get into the scout, though, is why 2027. I think that there was some confusion about what circumstances lead a player who will be 22 for the 27th draft to wait a year to come to the United States. The answer is actually very simple. It comes down to academics. The academic calendar on the university level in Japan is not the same as it is in the United States. Getting him enrolled for 2026 was not possible. And so while he will be a year older than most first round draft caliber players in 2027, that is the soonest that he'd be able to play college baseball. So, this is the fastest path to American pro ball for a guy of his caliber who had, like you said earlier, first overall MVP potential. And now he'll be able to play college ball in 27 once he gets some summer classes and fall classes in order to be able to go and play athletically and then get drafted. Now, for the fun part, let's talk about the scout here. I wrote a story. You can check it out at baseballamerica.com/college on what I was hearing, some things that I was seeing when breaking down Jennai Sato. The basics are this. He is an undersized right-hander, 5'11", 180 pounds. He has a four-seam fastball that sits 97 to 98. It touched 99 against the U.S. Collegiate National Team over the summer in Japan. It has apparently been up to 100 miles per hour based on some conversations that I've had. I had one person tell me he heard that he was up to 101. So there is potential for triple-digit velocity. Fastball's got good carry, flat attack angle. And then the highlight of the show is this high 80s to low 90s splitter that Rock Chalowski said was one of the best splitters he's ever faced. I've gotten double plus grades on that pitch. I heard from another source that Team USA's entire roster was kind of talking about how this closer for Japan is super dirty and it's the splitter that carries the arsenal, and they couldn't really see it out of this high three quarters launch. Just an interesting arm. There are some flaws. I want to kick it to you. What were some of the things that stood out in your first limited look via video of Jennai Sato? And I guess just how viable is it that he has two plus, if not double plus, offerings within that mix?
Yeah, I mean, when we first found out about this kid, and this was last week with your story, just like you did, I ran over to Synergy and watched how he did against USA this summer. I mean, he struck out Rock, AJ Gracia, Eric Becker, Drew Burris, Ryder Helfrich. I mean, he more or less dominated a really, really good lineup this summer, granted in kind of a, you know, shortish reliever type stint, but you know, the pure stuff with him is really exciting. Obviously, he's this little and undersized right-hander, which is kind of a tough demographic. But the fastball split combo, no doubt, plus, like the fastball, like you said, it sits in the high 90s, been up to 99, allegedly into the triple digits already. But the velo is one thing. I think the underlying under the hood data also helps it play perhaps up above its velocity band a little bit. Like, tons of carry through the zone. It's a really flat approach angle. So, I mean, when he commands it consistently in the top half, top third of the strike zone, I mean, it looks like probably 110, 115, just like absolute rise ball type deal. But, you know, for as impressive as his heater is, the splitter is, it seems to be the calling card of his arsenal from what we know and what we've seen, like upper 80s, low 90s power split with a ton of tumble, throws it with conviction. He'll use it against righties and lefties. So, I mean, that 1-2 punch gives him a solid foundation, but I will be really curious to see if he's able to develop a better feel to spin the baseball. The slider's below average, at least I thought, and kind of lacks teeth. Same can be said for like a sparingly used curveball. And then also the command and control are fringy. So, I mean, if he can develop a viable third pitch, consistently compete in and around the strike zone, those are kind of the two big question marks I have with him. And if he's able to do that between whenever he arrives on campus and up until the draft. But the foundation is super, super exciting. I think it's hard to not be pretty juiced up about it. But, you know, it doesn't come without some areas of improvement. And, you know, flaws is kind of harsh, you know, like, but you know, there are some areas that he can iron out and add some polish to.
There is also belief that there is some physical projection remaining here, even though he is undersized. I mean, by every sense of the word, he is undersized. But from the conversations that I've had, it does sound like there's a lot of confidence that he can put some more weight onto that 180-pound frame. And even if it's not more weight necessarily, there's like a functional strength aspect to all of this that I think excites some people, where maybe he's able to harness the mechanics a little bit better if he becomes a little bit stronger. We've seen that be really effective for guys at the pro level. They add strength and suddenly they start to clean up the control, and you know, the mechanics start to kind of fall into line. I think that could possibly be a factor here. The big thing, as you mentioned, is the potential lack of feel for spin. It does sound like there is a chance that this is a premium two-pitch arsenal that backs up a rather significant amount when you start talking about the tertiary level stuff. You mentioned a two-plane slider. I heard from one evaluator that they thought that maybe the best way for him to go would be to add a gyro slider, something that relies on less spin efficiency in order to have some sort of breaking ball. The curveball, as you said, kind of got consistent below average grades for me, 40s for most of the people who I talked to. I wonder if that's a pitch that kind of gets retailored, reshaped in order to be, whether it's a different grip or he starts, you know, eliminating it and focusing a lot more on that low efficiency slider that I mentioned that's going to have some vertical depth to it. I think that those are kind of the avenues to ironing out a third pitch or a fourth pitch. But it does sound like, at a minimum, this is a guy with premium arm talent. He has two good to great pitches. And it's the kind of profile that either moves really quickly as a reliever, which is a, you know, kind of a tab that I heard get put on him in the conversations I was having over the course of the last week, or you get really bullish on the upside and you try and develop a starter's profile off of an outstanding two-pitch platform and you see what happens. One guy who it kind of reminded me of in a like a miniature, undersized way, but from how the arsenal plays and the profile of all the pitches, was a little bit like Roki Sasaki. Baseball America, all of us at Baseball America throughout the entire season, we're kind of having this conversation of like, Roki Sasaki is this premium talent with a plus fastball, double plus split. He's got premium velocity. He's a really good mover. He's an athlete on the mound. But the problem is he doesn't throw enough strikes and there's really no feel for spin in the arsenal. And it came to a point this year where he looked really bad. And then there were some points where he looked really great, especially out of the bullpen. Is it fair to loosely clump Sato into that Sasaki bucket from a stuff standpoint? I know it's not the same body or the same type of athlete necessarily, just from like how they're built, but it seems like the way the ball flies out of their hand is similar to a degree.
It's a hefty comp, but I think from a stuff, like when you're talking about the 1-2 punch of a fastball and splitter, yes, they are like Sasaki's splitter, for as good as Sato's splitter is, like Sasaki's, I think, is even way above where Sato's is, and that's a testament to Roki more so than it is a knock on Janai. But I think that there are certainly some similarities, which you touched on.
Let's talk about one more thing here, Sato related. This is kind of a broader, bigger picture thing. Rintaro Sasaki obviously was a headline grabber when he made the move over to Stanford. Same kind of situation. early NBP pick potential, comes to the United States to become draft eligible. Didn't go great for Rintaro in his first year at Stanford. This year, maybe he rebounds a little bit and kind of recoups some of that hype and draft stock. But the question more broadly is, are we going to see this become a more explosive trend? Are the Satos and Sasakis and Kenny Ishikawas of the world going to be players that we see make the move to the U.S. more? What are you hearing on that front? And I'll touch on it a little bit after you do too.
It's interesting. And I've given it a lot of thought, just like I did when it was announced that Rintaro would be following the, well, I guess it chronologically be reversed, but just like when Rintaro announced that he'd be coming over to the United States, I thought about sort of, you know, is this sort of a, like an opening of the floodgates kind of moment. So I'm thinking along the same lines right now with Sato, and there have been guys before these two, albeit less of like a prominent stature in terms of like where they're projected to go in the NPB draft. Like Itsuki Takamoto sticks out. But I don't know. I kind of flip-flop on it. Part of me thinks that, you know, between Rintaro Sasaki and now Junai Sato, you know, in two of the last 3 years, we've seen prominent projected first round NPB talents withdraw their name from the NPB draft and opt to attend a 4-year school. So I think that in and of itself sort of signifies a little bit of a change and a little bit of a trend. But I wonder to what extent that will be, because like, I don't think that now every year, every like top NPB prospect, college-aged NPB prospect is going to withdraw their name and come over and play collegiately. But I do think that it'll be on a more frequent basis. So I think that my answer is kind of a hedge, but I can kind of see both sides of the coin a little bit. But what say you?
I kind of align with what you're saying. I struggle to see this becoming some sort of explosive trend where early NBP guys are going to make the move. Do I think it becomes slightly more common though? Probably. I mean, it does make a lot of sense. If everything lines up from an academic standpoint, that's probably like, not to distract from the point here, but like that's probably the biggest thing. It's not whether or not these guys want to come over earlier. I think it's the viability of making the move, because you do have to be able to get into school here. That's not, I said this on the Baseball America Hot Sheet show on Monday. You know, these guys are still student athletes. I know that they're getting paid, and I know that college sports are a completely different landscape than they used to be, but they are still students, and you do still have to get enrolled at the school, and you do still have to be in classes. And there is a massive cultural shift. One thing that I've learned just in the brief time that I've been reporting on this process with Sato is that there is a massive difference as well between the American baseball calendar and the Japanese baseball calendar. It's not the same thing. And I'm saying this now for the first time on the podcast. I don't know that I've even put this in a story yet, but Sato was not going to play college summer ball this summer. It was reported initially that he was going to play summer baseball, then play fall ball, then go play the 2027 college season. That is not the case. He's going to be focusing full time on his classes so that he can be aligned to the American college baseball calendar and play fall ball. Is that something that a lot of athletes are going to want to do? Do they want to reinvent how their calendars work? Is it more attractive to go and make whatever you're going to make in Japan, where you are already familiar, obviously, with the culture and the language? And then in 7 years after you make your professional move, you're eligible to come to the United States as an older, obviously, free agent who can make your money that way. Is that the way to go? For a lot of guys, I'm sure it still will be. And that's why I think it's going to be limiting in terms of how many players we see do what Sasaki, Sato, Ishikawa, those guys have done, Takamoto. But on the flip side, what I'm hearing is that there is a growing interest in the agent world, which is what's driving the bus in every conversation. Draft, NIL, commitments, the agent talk is what the portal. I'm hearing that there's a lot more interest in getting involved in the Japanese scene with some of these guys who are super talented, 20, 21, 22-year-olds, getting them over to the United States for a year of college ball, and then getting them eligible for the MLB draft, which gets them to free agency sooner. It gets them into American development much sooner. And that is something that people within the industry are viewing as lucrative. And so I do think that it kind of opens the door a little bit more with every single time we see it. And one other thing that I'll say, there are some less popular names, some guys who are not first overall caliber players who are already making the move. You mentioned it before we even started talking about this topic of whether or not this becomes a bigger trend. These guys were not the first. They are in a long line of players who have made the move to U.S. college baseball in order to be able to do this and gives themselves a chance. I'll bring up one example. Arata Motohashi is a right-handed pitcher in Washington State at, Yakima Valley College. He's a 22-year-old. He'll be eligible for the 2026 MLB draft, and he is allegedly touching the triple digits. Right-handed pitcher. I have heard from numerous teams that he is on their list of must-sees this spring. That's a guy who wasn't in the NBP conversation, who's in the United States. And based on the buzz that I'm hearing in December, it sounds like he is somebody who's going to get a pretty decent scouting look, and there's going to be a presence at Yakima Valley in the spring to try and draft this guy. I think that there are more athletes in Japan who fall under that umbrella who could ultimately make the move to the United States and follow this track, and we will see it increase in that way. At the top end, I don't know, maybe a little bit, but I think broadly speaking, the Japanese baseball player coming to the United States for college baseball is something I think we will see increase.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm happy you hit on it with the arm in the Pacific Northwest, but there are also a lot of Japanese prospects who will come over and start out at a junior college. And you talking about the arm, whose name I would almost certainly butcher, hence why I'm referring to him as the arm. But a guy that followed a similar path was Riku Nishida, who started out at Mount Hood Community College and then ended up at Oregon. One of, like, his prospect status was his prospect status. Like, he was always, you know, a day three guy, big time hit over power, like borderline double plus batch ball skills. But anyways, in terms of the enjoyment I got out of watching a player play, Riku ranks at or near the top of my list of guys that I've watched. This is a crazy aside, but I mean, it's our last episode before we go on a little break. We can have a little fun with it. But I remember watching, it was the Cape League playoffs, and it was Hyannis at Kituit. Hyannis gave the freaking belt to Kituit. But anyways, Riku walked to lead off the game, or to lead off an inning. And the poor pitcher on the mound for Kituit, I forget who he was, but he was, the lights were a little bright. I'll just leave it at that. And then he had a real tough time controlling the run game. Riku swipes second. I think he gets there without a throw. Next pitch, swipes third. Pretty easily got an awesome jump lead. Then the following pitch was a foul ball. And then on the fourth pitch of the at-bat, you know, Riku creeps down the line, the third base line at third. And then kind of like sort of makes like sort of a half-hearted move back to the base as any, you know, runner would. Who's on third in that situation. But he kind of dekes it out and waits for a lollygagged throw back to the mound from the catcher. And then he steals home, straight steal home, like unreal play. One of the toughest guys to get out, one of the toughest guys to strike out in the league that year. But anyways, that was kind of a somewhat pointless aside, but I'll sort of rein it back in by saying, like, yes, I think that there will be an increase of Japanese prospects coming over to the United States. What caliber they are, we'll see. But I think that Sato and Sasaki are two pretty big names in the last 3 years.
A lot to look forward to, I think, in terms of what that demographic could bring to college baseball. It'll be interesting to see how exactly Sato comes over and what kind of success he can generate, especially in a conference like the Big Ten, where I think he's going to be one of the better pitchers immediately, even if it's as somebody with two pitches. Peter, I want to take a look back as we start to come to a close here on this episode at 2025. Great year for college baseball. And I think that, I mean, you could make the argument now that were 3-4 years running where the most recent college baseball season has arguably been the best one. And the level of excitement in the sport and the level of excitement for the sport has increased dramatically in recent years. The viewership is up. College World Series was outstanding. The level of excitement is crazy. The level of prospect right now that's playing in college baseball and then subsequently getting into the pro game is unlike anything I think we've ever seen before. The rapid pace in which guys are ascending the minor leagues and making their major league debuts and having an impact. Nick Kurtz, this was a huge year for him. Rookie of the year, a year removed out of Wake Forest. Trey Savage breaks records in the World Series for a rookie. He was pitching in a regional in 2024. So the pace is crazy. College sports are in a great spot, college baseball in particular. My question is, can you single out one moment from 2025 as we get ready for 2026 that stood out as your favorite?
When you brought it up pre-show, I think I had a similar reaction because there are so many to choose from. And I think that, you know, the point that you brought up of the sport being in a great place is it could not be more true. And that's due to a number of folks, both within the space of covering it and then also an enormous amount due to the product on the field and in the caliber of players we see. But in terms of a single moment, what stood out to me was, and I brought it up to you, is like, I guarantee you won't have this moment. Cause I don't want to say like it's smaller than another, but it's perhaps underrated in the grand scheme of things. But I'm going to go with Parker Byrd from East Carolina, collecting his first collegiate hit against William & Mary. And then also 2 days earlier, drove in his first collegiate RBI against VCU. And for those wondering why that's significant, Parker a few years ago lost his right leg in a really unfortunate boating accident, was a really high caliber recruit for East Carolina and was projected to make a significant impact, which he has done on the program. Has he logged the amount of at bats, you know, that he was envisioning, you know, as a high school junior and senior? No, but the impact that he's made on the program has been, you know, perhaps 10 times more significant than it could have ever been. Just an all-time story of perseverance and resiliency and not giving up when he very easily could have, and I think 99.99 repeating percent of the population would have. He didn't and said, you know, screw you for the sake of keeping the podcast clean to anyone who thought he couldn't. And he made his collegiate debut last year, it built off of that. And then this year logged his first hit, drove in a run. I just think it's really, really cool, on a whole lot of levels. And I know that, you know, when I watched that and when you did, and really anyone did, knowing that story, it's hard to not be pretty moved by that. So I think that that's 1-1 for me.
No, I actually, I'm glad you said that, 'cause I don't know if this would have been the same 2025 kind of look back if we didn't highlight what is easily, in my opinion, the greatest personal achievement, unless I'm forgetting something completely that would be very extreme, the greatest personal achievement in college baseball in 2025. So I'm glad that that's a great moment. Mine is more geared towards college baseball history and personal achievement for sure. Obviously, it's not of the same caliber. I think that it's hard for this one to go after what you just said, but Gage Woods' no-hitter in the College World Series was, I mean, it was one of the coolest games that I have ever attended in terms of just the sheer magnitude of what we witnessed. He struck out 19 batters against Murray State. He was an error away from a hit-by-pitch away from a perfect game, and just the sheer dominance that we watched. And it was funny because I believe the night before that happened, you and I on our live show had said the college baseball World Series is always primed to create a star. One person does something spectacular there and it just changes their draft stock and the way that they're being talked about heading into the draft. And that kind of happened in front of us when it came to Gage Wood. There was a lot of excitement already, so it's not totally like that. I think Gage Wood was already in the first round conversation, thanks to what I think some people would tell you was the best fastball quality in this draft, besides or even in front of Liam Doyle. But to see it actually in action and to do what he did in that game to propel Arkansas to move on to a game against LSU was just truly surreal. It was right up there for me. And this is going to be a blast from the past, especially for any Florida fans listening to the podcast. Karsten Finbold in the Gainesville Regional, when he threw 9 innings of relief behind Timmy Manning, who didn't get an out in the first inning. Finbold comes on, and he was like historically great for 27 outs out of the bullpen. Unheard of type of historic, heroic performance. This was right there for me in terms of just jaw-dropping collegiate performance. And so I decided to go with Gage Wood. But man, your moment, you win that game. That was a great shout by you.
not looking to win anything, but great shout with Karsten Finbold, by the way. I didn't have him being mentioned my bingo card for this podcast, but awesome shout with Finbold. And then Gage Wood's performance, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, you know, you saw it live, but you know, any no hitter is dominant in nature. But I mean, 19 punch outs, and I think he hit a guy third of the game. Yeah. Like he was, you know, it's hard to say that if he didn't hit that, if he didn't have that one hit by pitch, he probably throws a perfect game. But I think that we're talking about it in a similar light, just because of how dominant it was. 19 strikeouts against a really good sort of team of destiny in Murray State, and he had this. He had built a ton of momentum in the draft, leading up to Omaha and throughout the season. But I think that cemented him, as a first round prospect, and he ended up being selected, I think, 26th by the Phillies or 23rd, but somewhere in the 20s in the first round. And he drew comparisons throughout the postseason and even in the lead up to the postseason of someone like a Cade Horton, not really for the type of player they are, but in terms of the draft trajectory and
the Omaha rocket ship.
Yeah. Sort of how it evolved over the season and then culminating with what Gage did in Omaha, I would be shocked if that is ever topped in our lifetime, perhaps ever. Like, it's hard to get any better than that. So it's without a doubt the best pitching moment of the season, bar none.
Well, if these are the kinds of things that excite you, let me tell you, Baseball America might just be the place for you. I cannot suggest enough as we get ready to sign off here on 2025. Head on over to baseballamerica.com/college. Peter and I are pumping out content, and that pace is only going to get crazier as we get towards the start of the 2026 season, which as of the day that we're recording this, which is Tuesday, December 23rd, is just 50-ish, I think it's 51 days away from the start of the 2026 college baseball season. We're going to have you covered. I mentioned it earlier in the show. The first magazine, the Baseball America magazine of the 2026 calendar year, is the College Preview. I will have a ton of stuff in that, including top 25 capsules, our first top 25 order. Peter and I will drop our first way, way too early projected field of 64 in the magazine. I will have several feature stories. We're talking LSU dynasty, potential LSU dynasty in college baseball. We've got a Rock Chalowski story coming, UCLA deep dive on how they've recruited and built what could be, hint, hint, maybe, the preseason number one team for 2026 after a great showing in 2025. So there's a lot to look forward to in that. Of course, like I said, rankings.
I think we got 5 conference previews too.
5 conference previews. There is a ton of content that's heading your way. That's both in terms of the magazine. Of course, that's at the website. Follow us on social media. We got a lot of great stuff over there. And again, just to reiterate it one more time, if you love baseball, if you love college baseball, head on over to baseballamerica.com. We have the entire game covered for you over there to the best that I think exists in the industry. And we appreciate the support. We, the two of us, appreciate the support throughout the course of the 2025 season, throughout the off season. It has been a pleasure. It's my first year. It's been a pleasure serving you and bringing you college baseball content. And we just look forward to doing it more. So for the final time in 2025, for Peter Flaherty, I'm Jacob Rudner, and we will see you in 2026.